If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
Welcome to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. I'm your host, Steve Stewart. We're here every Tuesday and Thursday at midday, 12 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in. Got a good show for you today. A lot of one day of school in the books. Listen, I did two drop-offs. You know, with the start dates, when you've got the elementary, middle, and high school drop dates, drop-off times, it's like basically 7:30, 8:30, 9:30. I did a high school drop-off and then a middle school, so had a lot of time. But anyway, one day in the books, I saw Superintendent Hannah said it was a good day, which means there was really no major crises. You know, it's interesting when you look at all the 33,000 kids you got to move to school and get them home safely. It is, you know, a major undertaking when everything is normal. And given the situation we're going through right now, it is obviously even tougher. But anyway, no major problems. But in the news today, we'll talk about that decision that the school board made in the last minute on Tuesday in regards to the mask. I want to go through the process which led up to it, and then we'll talk about what took place in the meeting. You know, I've been a little bit critical of the whole process that took place on Tuesday. Then I'll explain why, but it also raises a few more concerns about just, you know, how parents get their concerns heard. And, you know, we have been covering the school board now for over a year with a reporter following each meeting. And, you know, one of the things that we found out that, and this is talking to Superintendent Hannah, this is nothing earth-shattering, is that, you know, they give a lot of authority to principals. They've been described as mayors of small cities. And so that's sort of where you have to go to really get things done. But we'll talk about the impact of that meeting. Also, the federal trial here in town on corruption and pay-to-play charges is now in the deliberation mode. That started this morning. The final statements or the closing arguments from the defense and the prosecution took place or concluded on Tuesday. On Wednesday at around 5. And so deliberation started this morning. And, you know, we'll spend the 11:30 segment. We'll, or I'm sorry, 12:30 segment. We'll go through exactly the charges that are under consideration and also the closing arguments, which is, you know, where you really try to weave in what your message is. And the prosecution goes first and then the defense. And there's obviously some trends here on the strategy on what each is trying to do. And so we'll go through that and also just give you the specifics of what a verdict might look like. There are nine counts. And so the jury will deliberate all nine counts. Some of them are obviously interrelated, but we'll go over what those counts are, and then what it can mean for the community based on the decision that they reached. That's during the 12:30 segment. Amazon is a go. You know, they're going to build the big fulfillment center out of the corner of Mahan and I-10. That would be East Mahan. I want to go over just some of the parameters of that. We've got a lot of statements from local officials, most local officials. I will talk about the two that did not comment. So they're, you know, the economic development part of our, you know, government is Blueprint Intergovernment Agency. And we've talked about that here on the air. And that involves all 12 elected officials. That is 7 county commissioners and 5 city managers, and also requires the, city commissioners and county commissioners. And it requires the county manager and our administrator and the city manager to work together. So it really brings in both of the major local governments here in Leon County. And so we got statements or we got comments from all the elected officials and the two administrators, except 2 elected officials. I'm sorry, we got them from 10 of the elected officials. And we'll tell you the 2 that didn't comment on this project. And I'm not sure why, but we'll run through who that is. And also talk about some of the positive things. But I got a phone call this morning about one of the concerns. And This was a phone call that I enjoy getting because it's from someone who has a measured perspective of what's going on. It's one of the neighborhoods out that's going to be affected by traffic out at the interchange there in Mahan. And I want to describe to you basically what her concerns were. And also, again, you know, this is something, someone who is not, and I'm not going to obviously give her a name, but someone that's not necessarily against the project, but just wants to make sure that some of the impacts are going to be mitigated by, you know, local government. And so, again, it's good to get a phone call like that from someone that is just, look, happy for the jobs that are coming. And then, you know, but understanding that that intersection there, there's going to be some traffic issues. The Car Museum is there, but also there are concerts held out there because it's a big open field. And that's where you really, really run into some of the impacts of, you know, growing out in that area. But so we'll talk about that. But before I get out of this segment, I wanted to bring you up another school board issue. Actually, it may be a school board and a school issue, and that's the cost of tickets to attend sporting events. There was some stuff written about it recently about the football tickets, in the sense that, you know, pre-pandemic, it was $6 for parents and students to get into a football game. Well, now it's, the article implied that it was going to be $8 for students and parents, but now we're finding out that it may be even more expensive than that. They've signed on with a group called the GoFan app, where you basically buy your tickets digitally on your phone. And it looks like that's going to come with a 20% surcharge. So basically, it looks like now the tickets are going to be $9.90 at the end of the day, and the school's going to get $8 of that. Now, we're trying to nail this down, but I mean, that's going to be quite an increase. I guess even the $2 increase is pretty big for students. You think, you know, if you've got a family of three going to watch your son play football, it's it can be either $24 or $30 to go see a high school football game. Now, and that's not the end of the changes there. The other fall sports, for example, let's take volleyball. Pre-pandemic, the tickets were $5 for parents and $2 for students. Now it appears that the student price is going from $2 to $5, and then you got the surcharge. So the student prices could almost triple. And, you know, listen, it doesn't take a PhD in economics to understand what, you know, increasing prices means the supply will go down. And it's hard for me to imagine why, how this can be good for the schools. Now, it might be good for some administrators where it doesn't require them to do as much work. Might be good from the financial side of it, for the school getting more money, I guess. But, you know, part of this is that this 20% surcharge is going out of the state. So we're taking money from our local school kids and local parents, and we're shipping it basically to Atlanta, Georgia. So I think, you know, that obviously is a concern. And we're going to tie down the actual processing fee and the final prices for these tickets. But I just, for me, for the life of me, I don't understand why we can't, you know, schools have got all these clubs and these activities, these groups. Why can't we make these clubs and activities responsible for collecting money at these sporting events and give them, you know, 20%, 30% of what is drawn from the gate? And then that money stays here. It benefits a local group. Now, I will tell you that that requires a little bit more work from administrators in terms of setting up the process. But I really think this is something that should be looked at. I've talked to a couple of the athletic directors at the schools. One of them was not really thrilled about it at all. I asked them how it would impact people coming to the games, and they readily admit it's going to have a negative impact. So anyway, this will be a story that we will follow up on. But all right, when we get back, we're going to pivot to the what took place at the Leon County School Board meeting on Tuesday. I'll walk you through the process and tell you how and why Rocky Hanna got to his final decision on the mask mandates. So stay right where you are, and I appreciate you tuning in. You're listening to Steve Stewart, Above the Fold. To sacrifice our love. You never take advice. Someday you'll pay the price. I know. I've seen it before. It happens all the time.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart. Yeah. on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. Above the Fold is sponsored in part by Spartan Stoneworks. One of the most common and cost-effective upgrades anyone can make to their home is the kitchen. You're almost guaranteed to increase the value of your home with an updated kitchen, but quality materials like granite, quartz, and marble countertops can get expensive. Well, not when you go with Spartan Stoneworks. Pricing will be lower with Spartan because they don't mark up the cost of stone materials. The way they see it, since they didn't carve it up out of the mountains themselves, they're not going to charge any made-up fees as if they did. Give them a call at 765-2037. That's Spartan Stoneworks at 765-2037. And we appreciate their sponsorship. One quick thing I wanted to add on the discussion of the sports tickets at the local high schools. I'm comparing to pre-pandemic because last year there was a lot of issues, obviously, with getting people in and out of any sporting events, and some of them obviously didn't even take place. And so, the schools took some measures that were consistent with what the CDC was recommending. And so I think football tickets were $10 last year because there was only five or six games. So that's the reason why we were comparing everything that's going on now to a pre-pandemic year, which would have been 2019, 2020. But I want to make that straight. Now, we pivot to the school board meeting. The school board meeting puts out an agenda a couple days before the meeting, and there's a lot of things on the agenda usually, and they go through it. There's a consent agenda and other things that are discussed. But, this meeting on Tuesday, given the situation that we were in, was basically focused on the mask mandate. And I want to give you a little background because this is, this is still an issue across the state, and I think it may still be an issue here before it's all over with. Originally, Superintendent Hanna was very pro mask optional for parents, and that was the position that he was pushing in these meetings. There was some pushback every meeting with some of the members of the board and also some parents who would be speaking during the public speaking opportunities that you get there. But he held pretty strong with that position. Obviously, the COVID numbers started to increase, the COVID cases, and there was a lot of discussion about how maybe this variant, the Delta variant, was having more of an impact on children than previously. Because if you look at the previous year of the pandemic, one of the things that we did conclude, when I say we, I mean basically everyone that looked at the numbers, were that, kids were the least affected by the original COVID pandemic or the COVID virus, and that is reflected in the statistics. But now there's this unknown, and with cases increasing, Governor Ron DeSantis made the point that we were going to provide an option for parents to decide what was best for their children. That was pretty clear. Well, what happened was Superintendent Hanna came out and said, look, I've changed my mind based on who I've talked to here locally, and we're going to do a mask mandate with a medical opt-out from a doctor or a psychologist. And so at that point, this became much more of a political issue because now he was taking a position unlike some other school boards who changed their policy. For example, in Duval, they declared a mask mandate and that you had to fill out paperwork from the parent as an option to get out of wearing a mask. This was different in Leon County. This was a medical option. At that point, what happened is the Education Commissioner, Richard Corkin, sent a letter out basically telling Superintendent Hanna that he was violating state law because there had been a rule put in place by executive order that there had to be a parent opt-out. Not a medical opt-out, but a parent opt-out. And so Corcoran said, look, we're going to do an investigation. There's some options that we have here. There was talk about removing politicians from office that were violating this rule, again, that was put into place because of an executive order. So that was sort of the background of, how we arrived at the meeting on Tuesday. And so Superintendent Hanna basically gave the board that update, sort of a chronology of what was going on, and then read Mr. Corcoran's letter. And this is where I think, Superintendent Hanna decided to ask the board for their advice and for their input. I think he already knew what his decision was going to be, but he wanted to hear, I guess, from these elected officials. And this is where it got really dicey in terms of the back and forth between the elected officials. Dede Rasmussen took the position that, look, there's a law in place. We're violating it based on what they're saying. And, you know, this is not something that she really wanted to do as an elected official. Alva Stripling sort of followed the same approach. And on the other side of the aisle on this issue was school board member Daryl Jones, who, you know, didn't see any problem with, quote, breaking the law. He said, look, there are laws that have been in place before that were broken. He mentioned, you know, laws related to racial segregation, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And so he had no issue with that and was going to go with a mask mandate. Joey Bowen also was very pro mask mandate. And her, you know, again, an emotional statement that we can't teach the kids if they're dead. I mean, you know, that is, again, an emotional statement that is not supported by any of the facts that we have here in place right now. But those, that's sort of where the debate was headed. Now, Roseanne Wood, school board member Roseanne Wood, was also supportive of it. And this is where I get a little bit concerned, again, with sort of the direction that Superintendent Hannah took, is everybody starts talking about numbers, but they don't really give any numbers. Roseanne Wood said, look, you know, we've got a few kids in the hospital, and I think we need to do the mask mandate. But there's no discussion on about exactly how many kids we have in the hospital, why they're in the hospital, what are the parameters. And the same thing with Superintendent Hannah, who's talking about, look, you know, we'll look at the numbers and make decisions then. Well, what numbers are they looking at? Now, Superintendent Hannah, you know, was citing basically a pediatrician, one doctor that he talked to, and was basing some decisions on that discussion. So, you know, I would hope that this gets a little bit more stringent in terms of what kind of numbers they're looking at. Because if you start looking at the COVID updates, look, there are people that believe that this virus is going to do what viruses do. They have these surges. If you look at some biologists who are tracking this, that this is going to peak and be on the way down. The number of cases in early September is going to probably peak here any day in terms of the number of cases within the next 2 or 3 days. And that's how viruses work. The variants come in, they go through, they have a can be a seasonal surge. And so, you know, I think in a way, behind the scenes, that's what they're looking at. But at the same time, from a political standpoint, if you look at the state level, where Nikki Fried is holding these daily press conferences, they're trying to also make political hay out of the virus. And so, you know, we'll have to keep an eye on the numbers, but we'll have a story up probably tomorrow that looks at just when some of these scientific studies of, you know, of how this virus is moving through the community, of when it's actually going to peak. And like I said, they've got to, you know, they look at each state, they look at the way it's transmitted in each state. And Florida is close to the peak right now in terms of cases. And, you know, I think it's something that when you're making these decisions that you really got to consider. And again, I think we should be talking about, we don't get in these school board meetings, we're getting much more emotion than we are facts from our leaders. Now, they will definitely call out facts that are spoken during the public speaking part of this if they're not right, but they're not really presenting their facts themselves or what they're making the decisions on. So anyway, all right, enough of the school board and the COVID and the mask. When we get back, we're going to pivot and we'll get you up to date on what's going on with the federal corrupted trial downtown. So stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold.
It's local and it matters. It's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3, our Thursday edition. First week at our new time slot, 12 to 1. Appreciate you joining us. So, the big news downtown is the federal trial, corruption trial, is headed to deliberations. You know, something that obviously has been the focus of a lot of the local news, and it's been going on for years. The pandemic put a big hold on juries. Or having juries, and so it was delayed, and so the process has been stretched out, and obviously isn't, you know, not a real positive thing for the community to be dealing with, but this too shall pass, and it looks like it will probably be, I would think, would be over this week, if not early next week. Deliberations started this morning at 9 o'clock, and you know, just to get you caught up to speed, you know, this is there's been two guilty pleas from an elected official, Scott Maddox, and his associate. And then, you know, this is an indictment, and obviously of a business owner who has been a very prominent role in a lot of different business ventures here in town, Mr. JT Burnett. But this indictment, obviously you would think that federal officials had talked to him and his attorneys, and you know, tried to work out something. That you know, they like to get guilty pleas, not necessarily go to trial. Evidently, from what I read, they have a pretty successful record when they go to trial. And so, this has been basically about a 12 to 13 day trial. JT Burnett is basically looking at 9 counts, and they revolve around 3 different things. First of all, there is the perjury counts, which revolve around an interview the FBI did with him at his house during this investigation. I believe there are 3 or 4 issues there that they are basically charging him with perjury. The other two are the have to do with bribery at different times. And I think this is a very interesting thing to note, is one of the charges on bribery has to deal with the undercover FBI agents. When they were here in town and they were traveling around to different cities under the guise of them doing business here in Tallahassee. And, you know, it has to do with JT Burnett facilitating a relationship, a financial relationship with the then city commissioner, Scott Maddox, in the sense that, you know, he had to be paid to get things done. And those involve 4 $10,000 payments to Mr. Maddox's consulting firm, which he said he wasn't running at the time, but has since admitted he really was. So that's the one charge on the bribery corruption. The other one has to do with something that happened before the undercover FBI agents ever even got to town. What happened is it has to deal with the McKibben Hotel project, which we covered extensively at Taos Reports when it was happening. But how this became an issue of corruption is that, from what I can tell, is that Mr. Burnett was sort of bragging about this with the undercover FBI agents. And also, this is something that the defense is arguing that City Commissioner Scott Maddox and his associate, who have worked out a plea deal, pled guilty in exchange for cooperation, sort of brought to the feds as part of their negotiating with the feds. And so now that involves a $100,000 payment from allegation from Mr. Well, I guess the allegation is it was bribery. There's definitely the payment definitely took place. $100,000 payment to Mr. Maddox and the company governance. Now, I've been able to talk to a couple people who were in the courtroom during the final statements of the prosecution and the defense. And I think there's an interesting tactics here, and you can tell that they're very different. The prosecution is going through this very methodically in terms of a timeline. They're playing audio recordings and sometimes video recordings of Mr. Burnett talking to the undercover FBI officials. And as you know, this is again, they're arguing that the facts show violations of the counts that Mr. Burnett has been charged with. And so they go through this in a very methodical way. Now, on the other hand, the defense is, and this is, I don't think, obviously, is not new. You've got 12 jurors. The decision has to be unanimous. So you're trying to put doubt in just one juror. And so you try to reach out to emotions, and maybe you also try to confuse the jury a little bit. And I think that's sort of, that's what we heard. And if you look at the text messages from reporters who are there covering the trial, it seems to be the trend that you see. I think, again, Mr. Burnett, who took the stand on his own behalf, was pretty clear that he felt he was being extorted and wanted the jury to understand that he was being extorted from City Commissioner Maddox. And, you know, and the issue with that argument is if you don't have anything to counter that, is that there's a lot of evidence that shows that Mr. Maddox did put pressure on people to pay, that he was vindictive and actually followed through on some threats that if you did not pay to get business done here in Tallahassee, that it would be a problem for you. I think the problem that Mr. Burnett runs up against is obviously there's nothing more powerful than audio recordings of people saying things. You know, you're left to get on the stand and say, listen, I was bragging about that. I didn't mean that. I was telling them what I thought they wanted to hear. And so those are your defenses, you know, when you when they have those audio recordings. And, you know, again, when Mr. Maddox pled guilty, it's just not his guilty plea was not just related to the charges that you see here against Mr. Burnett. He had a lot longer list of charges. And again, the same audio recordings, the same factual type of evidence. So, anyway, everything has been sort of presented to the jury at this time. There's 12 jurors. There's no alternates. So these will be the 12 that will decide it. From what I'm reading is they will go ahead and deliberate until about 5 today and then decide if they're close to reaching a verdict or if they will, you know, break and come back again tomorrow. Again, I've been on a jury one time before, and timing plays a huge issue in reaching decisions. Now, I'm not saying it's an issue on guilty or not guilty, but when you've got 9 counts and you're moving through those, look, these jurors do not want to have to come back Monday. I will almost guarantee you that this will be solved, or that there will be a verdict by Friday at 5 o'clock. And again, that doesn't mean they're not doing their job. It just means that they're looking, look, we got 2 days to deliberate, you know, or actually, I guess it would be 3 because they, no, it'll be 2. They started this morning. So, you know, let's get this done. Let's get through this and, you know, and sort of go from there. So it'll be interesting to see what eventually happens. Now, if you pivot to the decision, you know, ironically, you know, it's coming amid a lot of recriminations by some local officials that are writing some My Views that we've talked about here on the show that are taking this this trial and some of the things that have come out on the stand and selectively using this to sort of beat up the business community. And I think, again, it's probably, depending on what happens, I mean, what was said in the trial is not going to change. I think that we've talked about the fact that, you know, our society's set of norms have changed over the years. And, you know, if you don't go to jail, if you're not found guilty in a court of law, pretty much everybody tends to look the other way from a lot of perspectives. There's not a lot of sanctions from local government. There's not groups that are going to say, look, you know, after what you spoke about on the stand, you know, we don't want to do business with you. There's, you know, we do have an ethics committee with the city of Tallahassee now, an independent ethics committee. You know, we understand that the city is looking at some of the contracts that Mr. Maddox was involved with. But beyond that, are they going to look at this testimony and say, look, we need to issue some letters of concern to some people who are currently employed here at the city of Tallahassee? We need to look at people who have since left. I just don't know where this is going to go. I think that for a lot of people in the community that, you know, they're living their daily lives, they knew there was some corruption issues. It's just moving forward. I think that from the insider perspective, there may be some decisions about, look, who's working on campaigns? Who do you take donations from? Things of that nature. But, you know, it will be interesting to see if there's actually resolutions at taken in some of these local government boards to highlight, you know, the problems that we've had over the last 5 to 10 years in terms of obviously some criminal behavior and then definitely unethical behavior that's not only, you know, been revealed with some of the ethics complaints that were filed, but also through some of the testimony in this federal trial where people have to, you know, they basically have to tell the truth. And some of that stuff is not the best, you know, it's not the best things to look at when you've said some other things previously that you've said, you know, you've claimed that I haven't done anything wrong, this is not unethical. And then you get on the stand and you really have to tell the truth and you find out, well, hey, it's not very, a lot of people look and say that's not consistent with what you said previously. And so anyway, that's going to be some of the fallout once this verdict is reached, which I think will happen in the next couple of days. All right, when we get back, our remaining segment, we'll talk about the Amazon project. It's a go. As most people know, Project Mango turned into Amazon. We'll talk about some of the benefits, some of the concerns, and we'll hear from what elected leaders had to say. And also, some elected leaders decided not to speak. We'll tell you who they were. So stay tuned for our last segment here on our Thursday edition of Above the Fold. We'll be right back after this break.
It's local and it matters. It's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. Appreciate you joining me. Above the Fold is brought to you in part by Epps Decorating Center. If you're a homeowner, you should always be looking for ways to increase the value of your home, but it doesn't always have to be a major project. A fresh coat of paint can transform the interior and exterior of your home in a dramatic way, and I recommend you start with Epps Decorating Center, Tallahassee's premier Benjamin Moore paint retailer. Whether you need interior, exterior paint, high-end, or commercial-grade coatings, Epps Decorating Center is ready to serve you. Give them a call at 385-6649. That's 385-6649. We appreciate their sponsorship Above the Fold and want to pivot to some good news. Well, good news for most people. There's obviously concerns when you have a company like Amazon coming to your community, but you know, the long-awaited decision that everybody sort of knew is that Project Mango, the code name for this fulfillment center that would be moving to Tallahassee, was revealed this week just ahead of the Chamber Conference, which is taking place this weekend at Amelia Island. But anyway, 1,000 full-time jobs with, you know, basically at least $15 an hour starting jobs. And this is going to be, I believe, a 600,000 square foot facility at its corner of East Mahan and I-10. And you know, this is something that I think that the city of Tallahassee has been trying to get to since Dan Foss Turbocor moved here. God, I bet it's been 20 years ago. He's been the major, you know, company that has moved to Tallahassee. That the economic development people hold out is, look, this is what we've done. This will at least now put Amazon squarely in the winner circle for us in terms of, you know, what is happening in Tallahassee. This is a big deal. And, you know, this is something, these things pop up all over the country. So this is not something that's real big for them to move into a community and get it done. I understand they're going to start construction in a month and should be open in a year. The research that we did at Tallahassee Reports, when there was some talk about this coming forward, these fulfillment centers, they get up pretty quick and they hire people very quick. I mean, they're looking at 1,000 full-time jobs. One of the areas we looked at one of these centers was in Charlotte, North Carolina, just outside Charlotte. And they had promised 1,000 jobs. And I think within 8 months, they had met that requirement. And so it will be interesting to see how, first of all, how it impacts our job market. Are we able to really get people that need these jobs employed at Amazon? Because, I mean, this should just be, in terms of entry-level jobs starting at $15 an hour, with also having some management jobs, I think this will be obviously a big shot in the arm. Now, you know, as I said, there are some naysayers, and the vote on this on May 27th to basically give $2.6 million in incentives to this company, you know, the vote was 11 to 1. Now, Commissioner Jeremy Matlow voted for it. City Commissioner Jack Porter was the only one to vote against it. I mentioned Matlow because those two usually vote in tandem on a lot of these growth issues. This is one he voted for. Now, you know, when that happened with that one vote, you know, the thing that Commissioner Porter is going to have to deal with is these economic analysis that show that it's, you know, going to create a total of 3,600 jobs around the whole infrastructure of the project, going to generate $451 million in local impact, $160 million in wages. So those are all the positives. Commissioner Porter voted against it, and I think we actually did a story at the time on why she chose to vote against it. She was very clear. She just doesn't think they're good jobs, and so we'll see. Only time will tell how that works out, but Amazon is anticipated to deploy about $200 million in capital investment for the 600,000 square foot fulfillment center. Now, the naysayers, I was talking to you about a phone call I got this morning. Look, I think the people that have problems with this project are going to come in a couple of different silos. I mean, there are those that are basically anti-growth. They don't want Tallahassee getting any bigger, and they don't want to see these type of projects. That's a group you're never going to reach. Those are the ones that, you know, they don't ever want a road built near their neighborhood. They don't want to make it better, the road. They just don't want it built. We saw that with the Northeast Gateway. How many of those people are here in Tallahassee? You know, I don't know. But given the way things operate now in terms of the social media, they all have voices. Now, that's one group. The next group is the group that, and again, I'll use the Northeast Gateway as an example. There are people that are not happy about the road, say the Northeast Gateway, but what they're doing is working to mitigate some of the externalities that maybe are going to impact their quality of life. And then there are obviously, there's a group that are just want to grow. Their livelihood is based on getting as many of these projects done. They're going to make a lot of money, or they're going to get, you know, they have something, some financial interest in that. So if you take those three groups and you take that and you look at the Amazon project, there are people that just don't want the Amazon project out there. It's going to generate, they live in a neighborhood out there. They don't think that any of the externalities can be mitigated, and they're against it. But there are other people, like the person I talked to on the phone this morning, who was really inquiring about, you know, some of the traffic upgrades that she hopes is going to take place at this intersection to facilitate people that actually live in that area moving around. And, you know, I think these are really the people that you got to focus on and that you got to really take care of. And, you know, the specific concern there is that you're, you know, if you go back and look at that interchange of I-10 and East Mahan 10 or 15 years ago, and you look at it now, there's been a lot of growth. The question is, you know, the Amazon project is going to result in even more growth. So are we going to get some upgrades at that interchange that allows for traffic to exit and enter on the interstate safely and allow people to move around in the area? Because I think, look, as this person pointed out, there's going to be more jobs created to support the Amazon employees out there. There's new businesses that are going to pop up there. And that comes with new traffic. And it's a lose-lose for businesses that are out there if all you do is just make it difficult for people to move around. You got to be able to move around to take advantage of the positives that are going to come with this project. So anyway, I think, again, we're going to be doing some stories and doing some research, talking to some officials, asking them about what are, you know, sure, we're going to build this massive complex there, but what are some of the plans for mitigating some of the impacts on the neighborhoods, not only the neighborhoods, but the other businesses that are there? You know, there's a Publix out there. Is it going to be next to impossible to get to the Publix once this is built, or do they have some plan to help alleviate some of the traffic out there? So I think That's going to be an interesting question, and we'll keep you up to date on that. All right, well, listen, thanks for tuning in today for this edition of Above the Fold. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next Tuesday at 12 o'clock. Thanks a lot.